Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jason Dick, editor-in-chief at CQ Roll Call, sitting in for Bill. Here in Washington, D.C., it's about 8:30 in the morning on April 12th. Abortion rights continues to roil the nation's politics. Coming on the heels of bombshell news out of Florida recently, former President Donald Trump released a video affirming his support for the overturning of Roe v. Wade and that the matter should be decided by the states. The very next day, the Arizona Supreme Court said, "Hold my beer," and allowed its 1864 territorial law criminalizing virtually all abortions to take effect. Democrats quickly pounced. Meanwhile, the Senate prepared for an impeachment trial, but the House left them at the altar, delaying their delivery of impeachment articles against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas until at least Monday. Speaking of the House, GOP leaders have struggled to round up the votes to reauthorize key sections of an intelligence gathering law. Is there any chance that the House can do other important things like fund an outgunned Ukraine against Russia? Here to discuss these topics and more are Catherine Tully McManus, congressional reporter at Politico. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor at the Cook Political Report. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Jason.
And Dan Merica, longtime political reporter who's writing these days in The Daily Beast, Notice, and others. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's actually, before we get into it, let's listen to what Donald Trump said on Monday as he released this video talking about abortion rights.
Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of Roe v. Wade. My view is the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections.
Jessica, let's talk about why the Trump campaign and Donald Trump may have felt it necessary to put out this video on Monday.
Well, I mean, we saw clearly that this was such an issue in 2022 and everywhere that abortion rights has been on the ballot, it has passed. But, you know, as I've been talking with people, we've never also seen it at a presidential level and how that is going to impact the presidential race and Senate races. And as we saw, you know, now this is going to be on the ballot in Florida. It's looking likely, you know, the Arizona law was just the most draconian you could have. It went back to before a time when even women could vote. And you know, these are crucial swing states, especially Arizona, in the race for the Senate and for the presidential. And I think there was certainly pressure on him and pressure from other Republican candidates to say something. But in typical Trump fashion, he said a lot of things, but nothing that was really concrete. You know, again, he wants credit for putting the justices on the Supreme Court that overturned Roe. And then the problem is when you send it back to the states, though, that you could find yourself, you know, especially increasingly in the South, just unable to find care when you need it. And, you know, I think most importantly this week, the Biden campaign, right after Trump put out that video, put out a really devastating ad that we've seen some version of in, you know, the Kentucky governor's race last year. We've seen this in a lot of races, of a woman talking about how she had a miscarriage, was unable to get treatment for it, proper treatment for it under the current laws and things. She developed an infection that she almost died twice and now is potentially unable to have children again because of it. So, you know, this is more than about just, you know, how many weeks and different things. This is about women's health care is what it boils down to and what we increasingly see that the states see this as. And, you know, again, I think Trump is going to be pressured. We're already seeing, you know, Republican candidates trying to sort of have it both ways and, you know, Carrie Lake, who was very stringent on abortion when she ran for governor 2 years ago, now trying to sort of soften that rhetoric. But we see a number of candidates that, you know, said things right in the wake of the Dobbs decision. You know, in Pennsylvania, they have McCormick saying, you know, praising the decision and different things. And now he's trying to sort of moderate. So I still think this is going to be a major issue. And it's one that, again, Republicans just, to me, the Dobbs decision was just such a Pandora's box that sort of be careful what you wish for, is that they'd been wanting this and, you know, highlighted really the alliance that they made with the religious right many decades ago. And now here's what happened. And now you've turned off suburban women and moderate voters. And, you know, I'm not sure, though, that, I mean, we could certainly see people vote for Trump and for, you know, an abortion measure or something, that the way that it is, that will enable them to do that. But we have seen that it rallies voters. I think it, you know, I think it has a special impact in Arizona. That's the one I'm watching. Florida, I'm watching to see. I'm a little less convinced there, just because Florida now is such a tougher state for Democrats. And I think that's true just across the board. So I'm a little more skeptical, but I do think this makes things tougher in Arizona.
For sure. I mean, especially with, you know, a Senate race, you know, a marquee Senate race like the one between likely Carrie Lake, as you said, and Ruben Gallego. This will be a very close race. And you know, Biden barely won Arizona in 2020, you know, a little over 11,000 votes. Catherine, we were in the press gallery earlier this week, and one of our former colleagues commenting on what Carrie Lake, you know, had sort of backtracked, as Jessica referred to, on abortion. And this this former colleague of ours, I believe he said, yeah, she's been to NRSC training school or re-education camp. Finishing school, yes. NRS, National Republican Senatorial Committee, finishing school. It just seemed like Republican senators in particular did not want to talk about this.
That's true. I tried the first half of this week. I was talking to folks in the Senate about it. Something that is tough for the senators right now to juggle and manage is especially the folks who had signed on to Senator Lindsey Graham's 15-week abortion ban in the last Congress, which, you know, was a big piece of legislation that Republicans wanted to use to, you know, put down their goalpost for where they would like to see a national abortion ban. And with Trump now coming out and saying, let's leave it to the states, it squeezes these Republicans a little bit, who know the political risks of disagreeing with Trump and saying, No, I think we still need to legislate this. I still think this needs to be an issue, frankly, that I'm involved in, you know, like as a member of Congress, to have a federal hand in it. But they also want to be able to tell their constituents, like, I'm fighting for this. And when fighting for something has you fighting against Trump, that is a problem for Republicans. Something that one of my takeaways from the Trump announcement this week was, I don't know if this is maybe giving too much credit, but it was Trump accepting a reality that he has not accepted, which is not always where he is at. The reality that there's not 60 votes in the Senate for an abortion ban, and there won't be for the foreseeable future. And there's also not 60 votes to codify Roe. And so the idea of letting it sit with the states is actually like a path of least resistance, because if you say, I'm going to become president and I'm going to sign a national abortion ban, that's a promise he can't keep.
And Dan, about that national abortion ban and Lindsey Graham, which Catherine was just discussing, I mean, you know, Graham said, like, no, we really do need this 15-week ban. But I think this is common sense. This is, you know, this is the way European countries, you know, handle it. And Trump just went after him on Truth Social.
Well, it shows one truth about Trump is that loyalty is very much a one-way street with him. He expects it from everybody else, and if you do not, you know, bow to what he says, he's going to come after you. And that is case in point with Lindsey Graham. You know, I think
Graham must be thinking, like, how much golf do I have to play with this guy?
Exactly. Like a few more rounds and maybe he wouldn't slam me for my abortion position. I think the video that he put out, I think what you said was right. You know, he said a lot but didn't say much. And there are hopes on Republican side that this is going to quell the issue for them, that this is going to make it possible for down ballot candidates to maybe embrace the Trump position on abortion and sort of moderate their position, knowing that it's going to be a huge motivating issue. But, you know, I spoke to a number of Republicans in the last few days, and there is an acknowledgement that even if they do this, even if they back off a national abortion ban pledge or plan, that Democrats are still going to say that that is what they hope to do, because so many have said in the past that that is what they want to do, even if they're not saying it now. Carrie Lake in Arizona is a great example. You know, she brought up this law in an interview when she was running for governor, not only brought up the law, but cited it by the number, like AS, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but actually cited the number of the law, the 1864 law that is now, the court upheld. So that's how familiar she was with this law. She said it was a great law. She cheered it. I think the videos that you're going to see more from Donald Trump are, you know, the Biden campaign and Democrats playing the number of times he has cheered the fact that he set the court up so that they could overturn Roe versus Wade. They have done that many times. They're going to keep doing it. They intend to make abortion a huge issue in this election. I think today you're going to see Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, make that very clear in a campaign event where she goes after Republicans on this issue and on the Arizona law. But I do think I want to say one thing about Republicans that I think should be said. There is a way where this could help Republicans down ballot, where you see in some House races in particular, you know, the House is going to be won in New York and California, states that already have abortion laws in their constitutions. There is a way, and we saw this in 2022 a bit, where abortion attacks were less potent in those races. Republicans had better than expected results in those two states. And you're going to see House candidates in New York and California tie themselves to this Trump position, I think, because of what they learned in 2022. And maybe they'll have a little more success than you see House candidates across the country.
Yeah, I want to play the ad that the Biden folks came out with, kind of quickly after some of this happened.
Because of Donald Trump, millions of women lost the fundamental freedom to control their own bodies. And now women's lives are in danger because of that. The question is, if Donald Trump gets back in power, what freedom will you lose next? Your body and your decisions belong to you. Not the government, not Donald Trump. I will fight like hell to get your freedom back.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's striking. And you know, Dan, you mentioned that the Kamala Harris, you know, like she sort of quickly pivoted to do a campaign trip in Arizona. We've got the Senate race there. It's a close race. And there are, I mean, you make a very good point about New York and California, where you have, Republican candidates who are able to moderate their positions or pivot. But there are a couple of like close House races potentially in Arizona too. Juan Kiskamani and David Schweikert are in potentially, tight races where this could affect it. And boy, when you're talking about margins as close as this House is, it's like every one of these House votes counts.
Yeah. And Republicans who are working on House races acknowledged as much this week, you know, after the Supreme Court decision in Arizona. The biggest concerns were over those two races for sure, because we've seen abortion is a huge motivating factor for Democrats. They've used it successfully ever since 2022. And it is likely going to be again in 2024. And Arizona is now absolutely ground zero for this debate and for the electoral repercussions of this debate. One other thing I want to say is Donald Trump is not the strongest when it comes to message discipline. So you better believe that he is going to walk back some of what he said in that video. He's going to say something to somebody else. When he's speaking in front of a certain group, he's going to say one thing. Maybe he'll, backtrack on that. Like, you're going to see a lot of different abortion positions out of Donald Trump over the next few months because he doesn't really stick to his message. And that is where he's going to get in trouble as well. Because even if he said this in April, he's going to say something different over the next few months. And that is where our problem begins.
Jessica, one state that I'd like to also talk about where this could have a potential effect is North Carolina. I mean, this is a purple state, although it has gone more the Republicans' way in recent elections, but it has been really close. The Biden people, you know, are making noises about making a play on that. And it also has a gubernatorial race where, you know, to say the least, the Republican candidate is in not only in line with Trump, but also has some of his quirks about message discipline and problems with the law. Let's talk about that and how also the abortion debate might factor in North Carolina.
Yeah, North Carolina is a really pivotal governor's race. And of course, it's an open seat. Democrats are defending it. And we saw in 2022 that, you know, really extreme gubernatorial candidates lost, like Carrie Lake and Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano and different things. So you have the lieutenant governor running, Mark Robinson, who just has a complete history of saying things about Nazis and Jews and women and black women. And, you know, he said that abortion is murder and things about gay people and transgender. And it's just a whole litany of things. And, you know, North Carolina did pass a more restrictive law, which, you know, again, was one of the last bastions in the South that allowed people to do that. So I think abortion is going to be a really, really key issue here, along with things that, you know, with things that Robinson has said about it. We did see one poll this week that came out that shows the Democrat Attorney General Josh Stein going up. But, you know, when you look at this regionally, like, you know, where North Carolina is, and really there's sort of an abortion desert around it for access where women can go and get care. So I absolutely think this is going to be a top issue. You know, this is a state that the Biden campaign says that they want to contest. I'm still a little skeptical of that, but you know, we actually have this race, that gubernatorial race rated lean Democrat, and it's because of Robinson's the ton of baggage that he has.
Yeah. And, you know, Catherine, we've seen, you know, in the House in particular, you know, that in 2022, things broke for a lot of North Carolina Democrats. The legislature in North Carolina redistricted, you know, after a bunch of court cases. And a lot of those Democrats are not coming back. They either chose to retire or they got put into these districts that are like incredibly, you know, Republican heavy, even though the state is kind of purple. So this, you know, a lot of these, you know, Democrats, you know, who are in North Carolina, they're kind of on their way out. But it seems like this may be the only way that they have for Democrats in the state to express, you know, what's, you know, their preferences are, because in the House, they're kind of like, you know, they've been sort of marginalized, and they go, and there's no Senate race. So it's just the president's race and the gubernatorial race.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that, like, the Democrats who are leaving came in thinking that they could be, you know, long-term House members, and the redistricting just changed their fate completely. Of course, some are running for higher office, but again, a tall order in North Carolina.
All right, we've got a lot more to talk about. We're going to talk about the impeachment trial that wasn't, but may be still, as well as what the House is doing on intelligence reform and also Ukraine aid. We'll get to that after a short break here on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jason Dick, editor-in-chief at CQ Roll Call, sitting in for Bill along with Dan Merica, Jessica Taylor, and Catherine Tully McManus.
Today's podcast brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Yes, those good men and women, 1.3 million working men and women strong, members of the UFCW. Under President Mark Perrone, they service all of us in many, many different ways at our big retail stores like Nordstrom and Macy's, the people who take care of us at our great grocery chains like Safeway and Whole Foods, those on the front line in our meat and poultry processing plants, chemical plants, and cannabis plants. We thank the men and women of the UFCW for their great work taking care of all of us Americans, and we thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod. go to their website, check it out at ufcw.org. You'll be amazed at all the good causes they're involved in.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jason Dick, editor-in-chief at CQ Roll Call, sitting in for Bill, along with Catherine Tully McManus from Politico, Jessica Taylor from the Cook Political Report, and Dan Merica, longtime political reporter. Okay, let's talk about the impeachment trial that wasn't. Catherine, we were waiting for the House managers, the House impeachment managers, to walk the articles of impeachment. They literally do this. They walk from the House side to the Senate side with them and present them to the Senate. This was supposed to happen on Wednesday. We found this out over the recess. And then on Tuesday, what happened? Because we're going to have to wait a little longer for this.
Basically, conservative Senate Republicans begged Speaker Johnson to hit pause. They know how their chamber works, and they know that Thursday, that's flyout day. That Thursday, the Senate gets a tiny bit done in the morning. The latest we see the Senate on a Thursday is usually 1:45 p.m., and then they are headed to the airport. And the conservatives in the Senate saw the writing on the wall that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer could call a vote on the motion to table, motion to dismiss, and close the book on this within a few hours. And they are pushing for a full trial, which in a democratically controlled Senate is very unlikely. But in order to give themselves even a chance to use delay tactics, use procedural measures to drag this out, they knew that a Thursday start date for any kind of trial was going to doom their efforts to, you know, really put a spotlight on Mayorkas and the border on the Senate floor. So by pushing it to next week, they are hoping to eat Democrats' floor time in the Senate. And I know that Senator Mike Lee of Utah already has, you know, a big list of procedural options. He cannot stop Democrats from dismissing these impeachment articles, but what he can do is call point of orders, try to make amendments to the articles, et cetera, and force votes on all of those intermediary steps, which will just keep the spotlight on this issue. What Republicans don't want is for Democrats to be able to close the book and move on to other legislative items, whereas Democrats would love to close the book and move on to other legislative items. So that will be the fight next week in the Senate. I do think that this is where you see procedure and schedule dominate things going in Congress more than policy even.
And Dan, starting the trial on Monday just so happens to be the day that would jurors would start being selected in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York on bribery charges connected to the Stormy Daniels case. It's a nice little bit of counter programming for the Trump people.
Yeah, would you look at that? A little smokescreen coming from the United States Senate. This is as much a legislative issue as it is a political one. Republicans have been very clear that they want to run on immigration in 2024. There are polls showing that there is a clear reason for that. There's more concern about immigration than there has been in the past. And this extends beyond, you know, just the border states where it's being felt most acutely. It also extends to major metropolitan areas where many of these migrants are being bused. And you see, you know, in areas, you know, outside of kind of the expected, areas where you think of border issues, this becoming a real issue. And so that is part of the reason for this. The more that Republicans and just Congress in general is talking about immigration, the more that Republicans think this is a winning issue and a way to kind of hurt Biden legislatively while Donald Trump runs his campaign against him. But yeah, you're absolutely right. A smokescreen from the Senate that maybe distracts a little bit from another one of Trump's trials is probably something that the Trump campaign will celebrate.
And Jessica, you know, it does seem like the two biggest issues that the elections writ large are going to be run on are, on one hand, if you're a Democrat, you want to talk about abortion rights, quite a bit, because that's been a winning issue for the last couple of cycles. And for Republicans, as Dan said, they want to talk about immigration and not just in conservative states, but in places like New York, where, you know, a lot of the migrants have been sent, you know, from Texas and so forth, and even California. So we've got Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, heading down to Mar-a-Lago later today to talk about election integrity and so forth. I mean, which issue do you think is going to have more saliency in some of these close races?
I think it's a little too early to tell, but from the ads I'm seeing, at least from Democrats, they are going on the offense on immigration, especially trying to separate themselves from their party and saying we've worked against this. John Tester, for instance, who is a big vote to watch in the Mayorkas procedural and different things where he goes. He's, of course, maybe the most vulnerable Democrat up in a state that Trump won by 16 points. He's talked about, you know, I've gone against my party on the border. We have to stop fentanyl and different things. And, you know, even another ad last week from Jackie Rosen in Nevada talks about this. So we have seen some of these vulnerable Democrats take a different tact and different things. But, you know, they're also using abortion. So, I certainly think that immigration is incredibly salient, but where are we? Where are the numbers on the immigration? As we get more stories out about abortion, I think those are really emerging as the two top issues, but which one is going to matter more? I think it's just too early to tell in polls. My boss, Amy Walter, has adopted a mantra of calling this the Green Day election when we look at polls, of wake me up when September ends, to see where polls are, that it's just so early. We have seen Biden have a little boost either from the State of the Union or maybe some of these, of some of these things that are in the news. But there's just a lot going on, and we're not sure yet where voters' attention and where their priorities are going to be.
Catherine, it seems like, you know, the House tries to outdo itself in terms of like looking like, this place of dysfunction. You know, there was another rule went down, so they couldn't even begin debate on foreign, you know, intelligence gathering reauthorization. This looks like they're going to try to work that out. But like Ukraine aid is stalled. I actually want to play this clip that we have from Troy Nels, who's a Republican from Texas, just kind of maybe in an unguarded moment here.
We're dysfunctional. We are. It's come somewhat embarrassing to make bite us in the butt a little bit in November. My focus is Donald J. Trump now, because nobody can manage this conference.
I'm struck by this. No one can manage this conference. Although Trump seems to be, almost like the shadow speaker here. What he helped sink the FISA reauthorization earlier this week. But he's got Mike Johnson, you know, who is, you know, subject to various threats to, you know, vacate his speakership from the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene. He seems to have Mike Johnson's back. I mean, what do we make of this? Are they going to be able to do things like get a Ukraine aid package and so forth if they can't even get rules, you know, which are typically, you know, the thing you take for granted?
So something I took away from the FISA fight this week is just the sheer number of big priority items in both the House and Senate for Republicans that Donald Trump has just kneecapped his colleagues on. You know, Mitch McConnell wants Ukraine aid. Trump says no Ukraine aid. Both chambers, both parties want FISA. Trump says no FISA. The bipartisan border talks that could have had a life in the House, Trump said absolutely not. I hate this. And so it is interesting to watch glimmers of hope or progress on major legislative issues that are huge agenda items for congressional Republicans, and to see the leader of their party come out against them time and time again. I think the Johnson-Trump dynamic is obviously something so interesting to watch. Trump ruined Johnson's week this week, you know, coming out against FISA while he's trying to get it across the floor. And yet Johnson's going to get on a plane this afternoon and head to Mar-a-Lago and give some kind of statement speech alongside Trump about election integrity. And so it just is this dynamic, like we talked about a little bit with Lindsey Graham, of are you going to help me or are you going to hurt me here? And it never seems clear to Republicans on Capitol Hill, I think, which way Trump is going to go for them. I think that Johnson keeping his conference in line is obviously one of the biggest challenges he faces. He is really week after week being put to the test of his whip count and what is he giving away in order to win these votes on FISA. You know, we've seen it was supposed to be a 5-year bill. It's down to a 2-year bill. There's changes to the program, changes to the authorities. And those are all happening after 19 of his own members voted down the rule earlier this week. And so to, as a speaker who came into office, of course, in a chaos crisis for the party, but saying we're going to have open discussions, we're going to have open talks about the legislation that's moving forward. And then he's making agreements with individual members, just like Kevin McCarthy did in order to scrounge up votes. So he's in that same position that doomed Kevin McCarthy. And yet he's still here.
And it seems like we've got a quick clip from Hakeem Jeffries, who was asked if we get a Ukraine aid package on the floor, which would trigger the, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, bringing up her motion to vacate, what the Democrats would do. We've got that quote from Jeffries.
Now, I've made the observation, not a declaration, the observation that if the Speaker were to do the right thing and allow the House to work its will with an up or down vote on the national security bill, then I believe that there are a reasonable number of Democrats who would not want to see the Speaker fall as a result of doing the right thing.
Dan, it almost seems like, you know, we've got Jeffries, you know, willing to save Johnson. We have Trump willing to save Johnson. is this guy maybe the weakest speaker we've seen in a while?
Unlikely bedfellows when you're talking about Trump and Jeffries both wanting to save Johnson. I mean, he is incredibly weak, but I think Catherine's absolutely right. He's in the same position that Kevin McCarthy was in, where a lot of his caucus supports doing one thing. The bulk of Washington supports doing one thing. And he's balancing that with the prospect of holding onto his job. We all know how that played out for Kevin McCarthy. Speaker Johnson clearly knows how that played out for Kevin McCarthy. And so that really gets to the question of which way is he going to go on this? Now, I think there are some Democrats who want to avoid the dysfunction that played out in the House around the McCarthy ouster. There are certainly some who enjoyed that and think it's good politics to basically have chaos in the House as the embodiment of the Republican Party. But this, to me, gets back to one thing. this is why so many people are leaving the House of Representatives. I mean, this is why so many people, serious legislators, people who wanted to go to Congress to get things done, are retiring or are leaving or are just throwing their hands up in the air and saying, see you later. It is a reason that we are in the teens for congressional approval. Now, I'm not sure if that will have any implications when it comes to the ballot box, because there are certainly a lot of people who hate Congress but love their member of Congress. But we're getting to a point where there really is just such a distaste for Congress among members of Congress that you have to kind of wonder if in an election year with all of these scenarios that we're laying out, if it's even possible to get anything done.
It's going to be it's going to be a bumpy ride from now till November. All right. Well, we've covered a lot today. We could go on, but it's time for our reporter's favorite story of the week. I am Jason Dick, editor-in-chief at CQ Roll Call, sitting in for Bill, along with Dan Merica, Jessica Taylor, and Catherine Tully McManus. Let's talk about these stories. Dan, why don't you go first? What story made you laugh, cry, or both? Or maybe it was just underreported and something that you want to talk about?
I'm gonna fully go off of a political story, and I'm going to go to the Women's Basketball Championship and the fact that it drew 19 million viewers, which was, I think, around 4 or 5 million more than the men's championship. I mean, I just think that's an amazing stat to cheer, and I'm not sure it'll repeat every year, but it's great to see women's college basketball kind of getting the respect that it's due. Obviously, a big part of that is to Caitlin Clark, who seems like a generational talent who is going to continue to draw eyes to women's basketball. I'm a huge basketball fan myself. I got to admit, I watched the women's championship and I did not watch the men's championship. So I'm kind of in that zone of people who are very excited for the women's championship, think it was an amazing game, all the credit to South Carolina. And I hope it portends more eyes on women's basketball going forward.
Jessica, what about you?
I'll just echo Dan really quickly before I get to my story. But, I grew up in Tennessee in the 90s, and I didn't know that there was men's basketball because the only game in town were the Lady Vols. So, this sort of new discovery of women's basketball, we would go to sold out Lady Vols games, and they were practically begging you to stay for the men's games. So I'm glad the rest of the country has been discovering it over the past few years. I feel like if you're from Tennessee or Connecticut, you've known this for a while. My also non-political story that broke this morning that probably should not come as a surprise, but the Golden Bachelor is now getting divorced. They've just married 3 weeks ago. So, many people, this is my political escape to watch, shows like The Bachelor. And this was a very different one because they were widowed and this guy had, such a heartstring story and everything. And he met Teresa, his name Gary did. And they had this big televised wedding, and then it was they were living apart and you could kind of see the writing on the wall. And then, so this morning they said they're divorcing. So, there's heartbreak at any age, I guess, but love is dead according to The Bachelor once again.
Or at least the Golden Bachelor, yeah. Yes.
the younger ones don't have much of a track record, And now that I watch the younger ones, it's like these people, these girls and boys at 23 being like, I'll never find love. And I'm like, please, you're 23. Don't even give me that. So it felt more serious when it got up to the 70s, these people knew what they wanted. Most of them had been married in some capacities before. So,
Catherine?
I missed the memo on the escapism for these. I have a story that made me go, oh no. And that is that the late Senator Dianne Feinstein may be honored with a post office named for her, which is a perennial joke in Congress, is how easy it is to name a post office after someone and how sometimes the bulk of legislative action over the course of a year is actually naming federal buildings because it's the only thing that they can agree on. And that just made me think once again about the senator's legacy, from her time in local and state government in California and then her long tenure in the Senate, and how a post office really doesn't capture or maybe honor her to the degree that she deserves. And yeah, just I laughed because I've covered many of those postal naming bills who are about people that, you know, you have to look up in Google and they're just kind of a local folk hero. And Dianne Feinstein was so much more than that. So maybe she'll get schools and other things and it'll be a compilation of things named after her. But Congress working on the postal bill just made me groan a little bit this week.
I'll join you in the groan there. my story of the week comes from courtesy of a fellow Bill Press podster, Philip Bump, frequent guest on this podcast. Did a deep dive on some of the other laws that were on the books from the territorial, the Howell laws, if you will, when Arizona became a territory. I mean, being a native Arizonan, this sort of when I saw the news out of Tuesday, it brought up a lot of questions. At first, I thought, wait, when exactly did we become a territory separate from New Mexico? So I had to do a little dive, and then I saw Philip's story. And one of the things that I, it's a fun read that some of the other mores of the time are that excusable homicides included if the blade of your axe slipped off and killed somebody, or if you were moderate in your punishment of your child or servant, that was an excusable homicide. So it's a real it's an interesting look at the way things were more than 150 years ago in Arizona. And I also it occurred to me that the Democrats may have an out here with the criminalization of every abortion, virtually every abortion in Arizona, because if you apply a strict originalist reading of this, I'll read the section that the persons who do this shall be punished by imprisonment in the territorial prison for a term not less than 2 years, nor more than 5 years. Now, the territorial prison in Yuma has been closed since 1909. It's now a state park, and parts of it don't have a roof. So if people were sentenced to the territorial prison in the originalist reading here, we just see how ridiculous this thing could get. All right, that's a wrap for this edition of the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. Our thanks to you for listening, and to Catherine Tully McManus, congressional reporter at Politico, Jessica Taylor, Senate and Governor's Editor at the Cook Political Report, and Dan Merica, longtime political reporter, writing these days at places like The Daily Beast and Notice. I'm Jason Dick, editor-in-chief at CQ Roll Call, sitting in for Bill. Next Tuesday, Bill will be back with presidential historian Doug Brinkley, looking back at our greatest presidents and how Biden and Trump measure up. Thanks again for listening to the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable, and have a great weekend.